Ms. Hines.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The District Court erred when it denied, without first conducting an evidentiary hearing, Petitioner David Phillips' 2255 petitions. The District Court erred again when it denied Mr. Phillips' motion for reconsideration. Mr. Phillips' 2255 petition stated sufficient facts that, if proven and developed through an evidentiary hearing, would have shown that he was deprived his Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel and would have entitled him to relief under the standard established in the Supreme Court's Coyler v. Sullivan decision. Specifically, Mr. Phillips showed that his trial counsel had an actual conflict of interest because of trial counsel's relationship with Melissa Musial.
So let me just interject here. I think you make a very strong showing that there could well have been an actual conflict of interest, but Kyler also requires a showing of an adverse effect on the lawyer's performance, and it's that second requirement that is causing me the most trouble, because when I look at the transcript, you know, the guilty plea, I have a hard time seeing in Mr. Lynch's representation anything but what I would expect any lawyer to do, trying to make sure his client understands what the factual basis is. You know, the client is uncertain, there are recesses, he says at one point you can go to trial. I mean, I don't know what he isn't doing, actually, so I don't know where your prima facie showing of an adverse effect is.
Well, Your Honor, with respect to that second part of Sullivan, it is particularly regrettable here that the district court did not hold an evidentiary hearing, because other than Mr. Phillips' confusion and apparent disagreement at various points in the change of plea hearing and the sentencing hearing, the record is relatively undeveloped on this point. But that is why in Hall this court explained that in the absence of an evidentiary hearing, a petitioner like Mr. Phillips is not required to engage in speculation pointing to an actual adverse effect. It's enough for the petitioner to state, as Mr. Phillips did here, when he alleged in his pro se petition that his trial counsel, he felt pressure from his trial counsel to plead guilty, and that that pressure was imposed as a result of his trial counsel's conflict of interest. In Hall, the court gives an example that if the case is remanded to an evidentiary hearing and Mr. Phillips is able to show, for example, that his trial counsel neglected to prepare for trial because he was pushing Mr. Phillips to accept this guilty plea, that that would be sufficient to establish that that conflict adversely affected trial counsel's representation.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the problem is we have the record of the plea change proceedings, and I mean, a lot of people come in after the fact, you know, with buyer's remorse on pleas, and they say all these things. And if there hadn't even been this back and forth, at one point the government even offers to, I'm not misremembering, to leave the plea on the table for a couple of days, and there are recesses, and there is some burden to go forward to earn that evidentiary hearing. I'd be very interested in, other than just simply saying, gee, I was pressured, when the record doesn't look like that.
Well, there are instances in the record, and keep in mind that in addition to the fact that Mr. Phillips at various points is contesting the charges during the change of plea hearing and the sentencing hearing, the backdrop of all of this is that he has a trial counsel who had previously represented this woman, and Mr. Phillips is alleged has a personal relationship with this woman's father.
At least in terms of this stage of the game, I think that there's a pretty decent showing of the actual conflict. And actually, the government's kind of funny to think of Ms. Musial as just a romantic interest, when the last I checked, the Mann Act actually suggests that he was probably violating the law, even if she was not a minor. But whatever, you know, I think that there's a lot that you were able to collect on that point.
Well, and I agree with you that at this point, as to that second standard, as I said, the record is relatively undeveloped, and that's why the relief that we're requesting here is a remand with instructions to the district court to conduct an evidentiary hearing so that Mr.
On the basis of what showing? On the basis of the original showing or on the basis of the arguments made in the Rule 60B motion?
Your Honor, we believe that on the basis of the original showing, if you look at the facts alleged in the pro se petition and the amended petition, there are sufficient facts to show the conflict of interest and Mr. Phillips makes the specific allegation that he felt pressured to enter into this plea agreement because of
that. This is, of course, a question that may matter. The parties haven't mentioned this, but I don't see how the district court had subject matter jurisdiction to consider the Rule 60B motion. Nobody here has mentioned the standards of Gonzales against Crosby, which holds that a Rule 60B motion counts as a second or successive collateral attack if it seeks relief on the merits. And this Rule 60B motion appeared to do just that.
Our Rule 60B motion asked the district court to reconsider its denial of Mr. Phillips' petitions, but what we were asking, the relief we were seeking, is to go back in and to rebrief the 2255 petition and have an evidence.
You were essentially filing another 2255 petition saying, got it better this time. Have you read Gonzales?
No, Your Honor, I have not.
Well, the ground that you just offered to distinguish Gonzales is the very ground that Gonzales said would make a Rule 60B motion a second or successive petition.
Well, putting the Rule 60B motion aside, and I will explain that we filed that Rule 60B.
You probably have to do that because, as I say, under Gonzales, it looks like the district court had no subject matter jurisdiction to consider it.
Putting that aside, we have the allegations in the pro se petition and the amended petition that would have been sufficient. The problem here is that without an evidentiary hearing, it's very hard for this court to evaluate whether the district court appropriately denied the 2255 petition.
But the plea record shows counsel making statements with his client there to the court. If he doesn't want to plead, if he feels that way about the evidence, he really shouldn't. He should go to trial and so forth. It's hard to read that pressure out of the record before the district judge.
Well, I think in the change of plea hearing and the sentencing hearing, as I mentioned, there are a couple of instances where Mr. Phillips begins to speak and begins to contest the allegations or the conduct that the government is describing that he is alleged to have committed. And at that point, the district court appropriately turns to trial counsel for an explanation. And in two or three of those instances, what happens is trial counsel and Mr. Phillips take a recess. They go have a discussion. They come back, and Mr. Phillips capitulates.
So, but here's, I think this is picking up on Chief Judge Easterbrook's point. Putting to one side what you regard as the strength of the showing on the conflict part of this, the actual conflict part, what distinguishes your case from all other cases in which somebody is going to say there was an actual conflict and I was adversely affected? How does Mr. Phillips get an evidentiary hearing on that and there not be an evidentiary hearing for every single person who just wants to come in and say, I was pressured?
Because Mr. Phillips said more than just that he was adversely affected. His pro se petition says that he was pressured, says that trial counsel told him, if you don't take this plea agreement, this is the sentence that you're going to get. He also, as part of the plea
wasn't
agreement,
that an accurate, or you, at least you could get, that was an accurate prediction, wasn't it?
That he could get, but we don't know because the strength of the government's evidence was never tested at trial.
Right.
What we do know is that as part of this plea agreement, Mr. Phillips admitted to the conduct in count one, but stipulated to the allegations of conduct in counts two through ten. And that stipulated conduct directly increased his sentence. Mr. Phillips, during his plea hearing and sentencing hearing, appeared to question whether he actually had engaged in that sort of conduct. So at least appears that there are some examples in the change of plea hearing and the sentencing hearing where Mr. Phillips questioned the conduct that he had to agree to as a result of this plea agreement. The other point that I would make here is that the government in the 2255 proceeding did assert that Ms. Musial had no reason, that the government had no reason to believe that Ms. Musial had witnessed any of the conduct charged in the indictment. And when the district court entered its order denying Mr. Phillips' petition, she pointed to the lack of any connection between trial counsel's representation of Ms. Musial and trial counsel's representation of Mr. Phillips as one of the reasons for her denial. Now, we know now that that is not the case, that, in fact, Ms. Musial was allegedly working as a prostitute. I see that my time is up.
Thank you, Ms. Hines. Mr. Mariotti.
May it please the Court, Renato Mariotti for the United States. The District Court properly denied Phillips' motion for post-conviction relief without a hearing because the undisputed facts showed that there was no actual conflict of interest that adversely affected his trial lawyer's performance.
As I said, I think this is actually one of the better showings of an actual conflict of interest because the law does not require identity in the criminal proceedings. There are some cases in which it's the same criminal proceeding. She was a prostitute in his ring. She gets prosecuted for that kind of behavior during the time period covered by the indictment, and he is now being prosecuted for running the prostitution ring in which she was one of the employees. And this is awfully close, and I would think information he gathered from her could well be pertinent. She was one of the people who was beat up, and you might well have said this is method of operation, so it gets in under 404B.
To be clear, Your Honor, she was arrested in October of 2000 or November of 2003.
I know.
The indictment concerns conduct that took place in October 2004, a number of transportations across state lines.
The indictment also covers, at least nominally says, from late 2003 through 2004, and I don't think you can walk away from that.
I actually, Your Honor, I believe that was in the plea agreement, but that, in terms of the factual basis, but underlying not only the charges of conviction but relevant sentencing facts, but the actual charged conduct in this case were a number of transportations across state lines that occurred at specific points in October of 2004, in addition to a 922G felon in possession charge, which also was at the time of arrest.
Well, I think that's nitpicking. If it's in there in the plea agreement, it strikes me that it's basically the same time.
The reason that matters, Your Honor, is because she was not one of the charged victims, and there's no evidence or even an allegation that she witnessed any of the transportations across state lines that are charged in the indictment, she wouldn't have been a necessary witness for the government at
but
trial.
But one of the charges had to do with violence, and she was certainly a victim of that.
There was a relevant sentencing fact regarding the use of violence against prostitutes in general, but there was an allegation of violence against a specific named victim who she was not that named victim.
That would be a more precise use of evidence than I'm used to seeing the government engage in.
Well, I think, I guess my point, Your Honor, is just that it's far from clear that the government would be permitted to introduce the testimony. And for a number of other reasons, the government had no direct testimony for Musial because she lied to the government, she refused to cooperate, she promised to always be there for Phillips because she was romantically involved with Phillips.
Right, have you ever heard of the Stockholm Syndrome?
I have, Your Honor.
All right. And by the time of the trial, she was no longer romantically involved with him. He was married to somebody else.
Well, that was at the time of sentencing, Your Honor, and the letter that was presented by Phillips and offered shows that in December of 2004, which was 2 months after his arrest, that I love you, I miss everything about you, you're going to beat this case, I'll always be there for you. That's what she was saying 2 months
right,
after arrest.
She changed her mind later, as people do.
This is not in the record. I mean, he could be that Phillips changed his mind, but in any event, I can't talk about adverse effects since that seems to be something of interest to your client or to your honor. I think that Phillips' theory is that his attorney pushed him to plead guilty in order to avoid having to cross-examine Musial. But given that Musial was not one of the prosecutors whom he was charged with transporting, she would have been a witness at sentencing. And that's why I think that that's important. Because pleading guilty there then would have no impact on the likelihood of her testifying.
You wouldn't have tried to prove up that he had a prostitution business?
More generally?
At a trial, had there been a hypothetical trial? I bet you would have.
Your Honor, I don't know. As I stand here today, I don't think personally that evidence would come in, but I guess it would depend on the theory that Phillips' lawyer took at trial.
And the government's theory that this is a man who's engaged in an illegal business.
Well, as it may, Your Honor, I mean, obviously there's nothing in the record to say one way or the other. I would say this. I mean, the plea agreement negotiated by Phillips' attorney was favorable to him. It dismissed.
Why was it favorable to him? I thought it was. I mean, not that this is a reason to set it aside, and there's an appeal waiver, and I don't have a problem with that. But I don't see that in the end it was all that favorable.
Well, it dismissed 10 of the 11 accounts against him, two of which.
Yeah, so what? He still got a really long sentence because of the relevant conduct.
Well, he didn't admit to. There was substantial charge conduct that he was not forced to admit to in that. In that plea agreement, he still got the 2 points for acceptance of responsibility, for one thing. For example, the possession of the firearm, he was not asked to admit to. And also, it took a conservative view of the cross-reference in the plea agreement. The cross-reference that the district court ultimately took a different view of at sentencing, but the government took the more conservative view in the plea agreement. So, and one last point I'd like to hit, Your Honor, is that there was a discussion regarding that there was a recess at the change of plea hearing, and that Phillips needed to be talked to by his attorney. But in the record, it was very clear that Phillips came later to the court and said that there was the presence of his mother that caused him to change, to back off from the plea agreement, and that he was embarrassed by his conduct. For all those reasons, Your Honor, if there are no further questions. The government would.
Yes, I have. I have one, which I assume you know. Did the district court have any authority to consider the Rule 60 motion?
The theory that was presented by Phillips was that the district court could ask this court to remand for subject matter jurisdiction. The government did not contest that at the time. At the point
I don't care what the government contested. Subject matter jurisdiction is an issue that a court must raise on its own. And the proceeding was not one in which there was an application to this court to remand for further proceedings in the district court. This was a straight Rule 60B motion in the district court. One would think it's subject to the holding of the Supreme Court in Gonzales against Crosby. And my question is, what is the consequence of applying Gonzales?
Based on what Your Honor said, I think it would be that there was no subject matter jurisdiction for the 60B motion.
And we count on counsel to deal with jurisdictional matters fully and candidly in their briefs. You didn't.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Your Honor. And that was not intentional. If there's nothing further, I would request that this court affirm both the district court's denial of the Phillips motion for post-conviction relief as well as Phillips motion for reconsideration. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Ms. Hines?
Procedures in Boyko and asked that if the court was inclined to grant it would enter a minute order that then we would come before you and ask the court be remanded for the purpose of having an evidentiary hearing. I am not familiar with Gonzales, but we did follow the procedures outlined in this court's decision in Boyko. With respect to the presentation by the government, I think a couple of points warrant following up. First, with the issue of the counts 6 and 7 in the indictment, those counts allege that Mr. Phillips used force to coerce the prostitutes to engage in commercial sex acts. They didn't allege that he used force against those specific prostitutes. In the PSR, the pre-sentence investigation report, there's discussion of how Mr. Phillips allegedly abused some of the prostitutes to show as a lesson to the others that they must fall in line. And I think that the alleged abuse of Ms. Musial would have been directly relevant to those two issues. Also, on the issue of adverse effect, we're really speculating as to what the effect was. And the reason that we're speculating is because we didn't have an evidentiary hearing. And that's why we respectfully request this course remand for an evidentiary hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Hines, we appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court and your client. The case is taken under advisement.